The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I work in the author events office here. And I'm really, really excited to be here to introduce classicist composer Philip Glass, one of the most influential artists of any stripe in the last 50 years, maybe more. Describing himself as working in, quote, music with repetitive structures, Glass's impressive and immersive work includes more than 20 operas, 10 symphonies, feature film and documentary scores, musical theater works, several concertos, chamber music, compositions, and I even discovered amidst writing this a bit of work for Sesame Street. He is the subject of no less than 6 documentary films, has collaborated with artists across a wide spectrum of genres, and has been nominated for and won multiple Golden Globe, Oscar, and BAFTA awards. Glass's new memoir, Words Without Music, depicts the stories behind his most famous music, his beginnings in Baltimore, his travels around the world, and the relationships, personal and professional, that have influenced him most. Interviewing Mr. Glass tonight is composer Kyle Smith, classical host at Philadelphia's WRTI-FM, a contributing editor at the Broad Street Review, and former curator right here of the Fleischer Collection at the Free Library of Philadelphia. So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, won't you please join me in welcoming Philip Glass and Kyle Smith.
Evening. Thanks for that nice applause. I'm glad you all came here to hear me ask questions. That's very nice of you. So with Philip, with 10 symphonies, 25 operas, that can't possibly be true, but it is.
26, actually.
It's just 26 since... Well, I finished the book yesterday, so it's 26 since then. 11 concertos. 5 or 6 string quartets, I think. 30 film soundtracks.
You can stop that business. It's okay. We get the idea.
So this is just all leading up to, are you the hardest working man in show business?
I call writing music a nervous habit.
A nervous habit. Okay.
I just do a lot. But, you know, the fact is that I it's what I really like doing. And I just do what I like to do. Yeah. And that's... It's become even more true as I get older. A whole day of writing music feels like a real good day to me.
Yeah. Early on, Ornette Coleman told you that there's a difference between the music world and the music business. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that not once, but a couple of times in the book, so it must be an important...
I'm still pondering that, and I'm not sure that... I think I probably knew a little bit more about it than he did, because I was more in the music business than he was.
Yeah.
I grew up in it because of my dad. He had a record in repairs.
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, how much of that do you think that it's affected your career
comes from
what Ornette Coleman told you, and is that locked in with what you learned from your dad?
Because of one thing... I was the record buyer for the store when I was 15. Mm-hmm. And we didn't... He was not educated as a musician at all. But he never told me which was the good music and not so good music in the store. Mm-hmm. It was just music.
Right.
And actually, there are a lot of... that's much more true of American composers than the European composers. We tend to be interested in all kinds of music. The Europeans tend to categorize it much more.
Is that so?
Yes, it's true. So then, I liked all kinds of music, and what I began doing at a certain point, I began playing with other musicians.
Yeah.
First, so people who were in the pop world or the jazz world, but then also people who were not from North America, people from Australia or Africa, China. Some of the most interesting projects for me have been the collaborations with other composers, which is kind of an unusual thing. But I found it almost one of the most stimulating things that I could do.
Well, the one of the biggest names that comes out in your book is Ravi Shankar.
Well, he was like a teacher. I worked for him, but he was.
And you worked with him, and you said he's the composer performer par excellence. He's the guy.
Yeah.
And you started writing film music with under
well, he was
a project with him, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. I actually did a little bit of music for that.
What did you learn about film music with Ravi Shankar?
Well, that was the first. I had been working. I was in Paris studying with a great teacher, Boulanger. But the Fulbright, there was really not quite enough money to live on. So I was always looking for work, and I started doing work. There was a lot of work in the film business in Paris, mm-hmm. but I was working in the doublage, the dubbing part of the business.
You would go in and you would dub.
No, I wasn't particularly good I wasn't a good actor, though I did a little bit of that. But when I got a job, it was really one line, like the elevator operator said, "Going up." That I could do. I started. Helping to write the film script. But what I learned a lot about how how you place the sounds on the lips, which so that later, when I was much later, I was working on film, writing film music for films that had been made already, like the Cocteau films,
mm-hmm.
like...
that comes much later.
La Belle et la Bête. Yeah. And then La Belle et la Bête was like that. And then I put the... I was able... I that kind of... practice that I had as a young guy.
That was a fascinating, and I don't know if this has ever been done before, where you actually took the film with the actors talking, and you matched the music to their speech.
Yes.
But you turned the sound down on the film, and it was your music.
I turned the film into an opera.
Right.
And I thought it was such a good idea, I thought other people would do it, and I would do it, but no one else did it. And then I just never did it again either. But I thought it was what was really interesting about it, Carl, was that by putting the live singer, I began to perform this live, so the singers, the film would be there. The singers were underneath the film, and my ensemble was playing in front of them. The audience was out there, but. What happened was that the film became a real performance then. I would say that the liveness of the playing was borrowed by the film.
Right.
And instead of being instead of being just a mechanical reproduction of a score, it became an actual performance. And it meant that the performers on the screen were performing too. So what was interesting about it, and I hadn't anticipated that. I didn't know that was going to happen. I just did it because I was experimenting with the idea. By that time, had done some film music. And what I discovered, which we all discover, is that there is a formula for writing film music, which is completely annoying. Which is that you come in at the end and you write all the music.
Composer's always the last one.
Last one.
Right.
And what's annoying about this is that the filmmakers rarely understand what the function of the film of the music is.
Right.
So that though on a few occasions I was able to work on documentary films with people who allowed me to work with them as part of the process of making the film, like with the films by Godfrey Reggio, the Cozzi films.
Well, this is what's fascinating because you came into film music, and then when you started writing film music, you said, "This is how I want to do it." And for some reason, they said yes. I mean,
No, they didn't say. Only two people said yes, and I did a lot more than two films. But I got Scorsese to say yes.
Yeah.
And when I did the score for Kundun, I was writing the music before he filmed it. I was already using the scenario. And it's not hard to do. A scenario of a film could be 100 pages. A film might be 100 minutes. So roughly speaking, a minute a page. It's not hard to figure out how to do that. And then you just have to make it longer or shorter according to how it may come out, but it won't be that
different. But you were having Martin Scorsese sending you the what they filmed that day.
No,
they
no.
They would edit it, and a couple of days
way,
later, you
the
would
other way
get
wrong.
It.
I sent him the music that he was filming that day. And Thelma Schumacher was with him.
Right, his editor.
They were out shooting mostly. Actually, they filmed that in Morocco. I'm talking about Kundan, the film about the Dalai Lama. Mm-hmm. They'd filmed it in Morocco, and then they sent a second unit to the Himalayas to do the mountains, and then they put it together.
Uh-huh.
It looks pretty good. You know, it looks kind of like you think you might be in Tibet, but you would never think you're in Morocco in any case. But he was there with the whole company were Tibetans. There was and one Chinese who played the part of the general. You know that film.
Yeah.
But if you don't know, it's a remarkable film in many ways because of the way what Marty was trying to do, but by showing what that world was like and what he succeeded in doing.
Okay, I want to bring up a word to get rid of it, and the word is minimalism.
Okay, you got rid of it.
Because
can we move on now?
Yeah, because what you've said over the years, and you say it in your book, I'm not a minimalist composer. And you said this is very interesting. I hadn't heard this before. You said, I'm a theater composer. I write for the theater.
Well, that has the virtue of being actually what I do.
Of being the truth. So that's a good answer.
Yeah. Well, if you consider that that theater would include film,
mm-hmm.
Dance,
sure.
And opera, almost anything where a collaboration, where the elements of text, image, music, and movement, yeah. Wherever those four elements come in, you're dealing with theater.
So define minimalism for us and
why should
your
I do that?
Is...
It was never my idea to begin
well,
with.
Well, that's a good answer.
there was the two people who contend that they invented it. One was a guy named Tom Johnson, who was a composer, is a composer, who wrote actually a three-note opera. Now that's... He was a minimalist.
That's minimalism.
He was. And he was writing for, I think, the Village Voice many years ago, and he coined that word. But actually, it was borrowed from a movement in the art world of minimalists, which would be Donald Judd and Saul LeWitt and Robert. There were a couple of people that were working, and they were called minimalists, and we knew them. There was a relationship in terms of structure, and I think Tom took that word and just used it, and then it became. I don't have to tell you. It became easier for editors of magazines and papers to use the word because it seemed to say something. Well, actually, the problem was it didn't say anything. It said the wrong thing.
Well, you say something really transparently. It's a revelation because you say. Who would listen to just repetitive music? Because what we listen for are the changes.
That's right.
In the repetition, and that's and it's not even that you have to develop a new way of hearing because we hear that way all the time anyway. And that's what you I'm guessing from what you said in the book. That's what you're trying to do in your music.
Well, there's another angle to this too. If you really want to have a serious talk about this, I guess we have to do it. Let's talk about the painters and the sculptors who were minimalists. What they were doing was they were removing the image, the narrative image from the painting.
Right.
And there are different ways of being abstract. You can be abstract the way Jackson Pollock was abstract, or you could be abstract the way Frank Stella was abstract.
Mm-hmm.
They're completely different ways. But what they both managed to do is to remove the image of... the still life or the... you know, it's really interesting because Bob Wilson, who I work with, he often talked about the... He did talk about images, but he talked about the mid-range, the far images, and the close image, a portrait, and that kind of thing. But what they were doing actually was removing the subject or the narrative from it. And that... was also done by writers.
Mm-hmm.
It was done by Samuel Beckett. It was done by Brian Gysons. It was done by... and the idea then was to find a way of telling a story which was not following the, let's say, the classical way of telling a story would be the way that Aristotle described it, mm-hmm. where you would have a hero and there would be a tragic flaw, and then after the flaw, then there would be the fall of the hero. That's the theory of tragedy was that, and right. it goes all the way back to the Greeks. That's why we like the Greeks, by the way, if we do like the Greeks.
Because the hero, the heroes fall, well, because there's a story.
That became the model.
Yeah.
of a narrative story, and it really took a long time before people began to get the idea that maybe a story could be told without that story. So the idea then became to have a different kind of structure, and what they were with the sculptors and painters were doing, they were instead of content they used structure, mm-hmm. and then an interesting thing happened because by doing it that way, the form and content became identical, which turned out to be a very modern idea. The real thrust of minimalism had to do with that. I would say that my generation of people were doing, we were responding to something quite different. We were responding to a form of modernism in music, which we admired, which I particularly admire, but which I had no interest in perpetuating or have anything to do with.
Yeah, when you're saying modernism, you're talking about European.
We're talking about people that lived 100 years ago. I mean, that's mm-hmm. how music, unfortunately, is very mm-hmm. retarded mm-hmm. that way. We still think of Schoenberg as a modern composer. Right. That's 103 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really a long time ago.
Now, you said that about Samuel Beckett, and of course, you worked on his plays. You said that he swept the table clear of
that's
modernism,
right.
swept the cobwebs away. Have you done that with music?
I don't know. I think I put more cobwebs in, maybe. I'm not sure I did that. However, and that you mentioned, working with him, I did about 8 scores for his plays.
Right.
And this was when I was beginning my minimalist period. Is that what you mean? Your ideas are prevailing in some warped way, I think. But anyway, but the thing. It was through working with...
We're talking, you're in Paris, it's the mid-60s, right?
Yeah, so mid-60s, and I'm working, and the company I'm with, we are working with Beckett. And he liked us, we were young, he didn't particularly want to spend any time with us, but he advised us about, he allowed us to do his work, mm-hmm. and he advised me about the music from time to time. So we had a real contact in that way. And one of the things that he did, which was really interesting, I did a piece called La Comédie, the play, mm-hmm. and basically it's a cut-up. He took a story and cut it up and put it back together. Now, that's a trick that John Cage did mm-hmm. with his Thoreau piece. Have you ever heard that?
I haven't.
I heard him read it. It was unbearable.
Well, I heard the
but I loved it.
The LP... The LP with all his...
Let me tell you what it was.
He's reading all his stories and they're 1 minute long.
He took a page of Thoreau
right.
and he took the words out of it and he took the words and he cut them in the words apart until they were just syllables.
Right.
Then he put it back together again and he read it.
Yeah.
Well, he sounded like it was impossible to hear, understand anything. I went to hear this at a place called The Kitchen. It must have been 1971 or 72. And he emptied the room in about 15 minutes. I stayed and a Dutch friend of mine, we stayed to the end, and we just stayed to see what would happen, you know. And he just kept reading this thing, and it took a long time. This is an interesting idea, the idea of getting rid of the narrative by taking the narrative and actually cutting it up and putting it back together, which is what Beckett did.
So you force the narrative to be of no account as a narrative,
well,
and then you force the audience to finish the story, if I can put it that way? Or to make the story for the...
What it does is it requires the spectator mm-hmm. to look at it in a different way. And what I had to do was find the music to go with it. And the earliest pieces were the pieces for Beckett.
Right.
And then what happened, I would take the music after we had done it with the play, and I would take it home and listen to it. And I found I was very interested in the music, yeah. and that became the basis of the concert music that I was writing.
You became friends with John Cage later on, and he said to
that's
you
that's an exaggeration, time, but we knew each other quite well.
Okay. He said to you, you played a piece for him, and he said to you, you write too many notes.
No, he didn't say that. He said, no, then, he didn't even say that. He would say, Philip, too many notes.
do you remember what you said to him?
I said, John, I'm one of your children, whether you like it or not.
I'm one of your children, whether you like it or not. That's right.
And he would just shake his head. But he liked one piece of mine, Satyagraha, an opera by Gandhi, mm-hmm. and he saw it several times. And Morton Feldman liked that piece too. Those guys, they didn't, and they kind of, they liked me. I mean, I'm a likable person. I wasn't mad at them. They weren't mad at me. I was very interested in them, and I knew what they did. Yeah. I just didn't want to sound like them.
Right.
I think Morty didn't care whether I sounded like him or not, but John liked people to sound like him.
Oh, did he?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Look at the people he worked with.
Okay.
Right? That's what it was almost like an école de John Cage, the mm-hmm. school of John Cage. Mm-hmm. That would be, David Tudor and David Berman. A lot of very, it could be beautiful music, mm-hmm. but there was definitely a stylistic similarity. Mm-hmm. A Christian Wolf, same thing. Mm-hmm. He couldn't figure out where I came from and where I was going. But we got along well enough. And one time he wanted, we met fairly often, and one time he wanted to talk about opera because he had a commission to do an opera. And we were supposed to have a lunch together and talk about opera, and we never did. And I understood from that he actually didn't want to talk about the opera. But maybe he wanted to, maybe I didn't tell him what he needed to hear. But the subject never came up.
And he never wrote the opera?
He did.
He did write it.
He did write the opera. Yeah. He wrote it for the Frankfurt Opera.
Was it Satyagraha or Akhenaten when the Cutty Sark ad came out?
When what?
The Cutty Sark ad came out.
Oh, that was for Akhenaten because Cutty Sark ad paid for the music preparation.
The copy. So the print ad in all these upscale magazines, Cutty Sark has you holding a glass of whiskey with like notes coming out of it.
You took
a lot of heat from that. From people who thought you were selling out. Right?
I didn't. I thought I was selling in, actually. I took the money and put it into the work.
Right.
But
because at the time they commissioned you for the piece, but you had to.
I didn't take any heat. I didn't care. Mm-hmm. I understood right away that the real problem was that they would like to have done the same thing.
Right. Right.
And I was the guy that got the call.
Well, in your book, you mentioned that that vignette, and I think you connect that to looking back at when your father had the record store, and you would see people give him $5, and he would give them music, and $5 and music, and it's like there's music and there's money, there's music and there's money. So it's like I'm not selling out. I'm getting money, and it's because of my music. So what's the problem? And
Stravinsky and Rachmaninoff had one very interesting meeting. These are two expatriate Russian mm-hmm. composers. From what I hear about that meeting was that they were a little, cool with each other when they first met. But then they began to talk about all the royalties that they had lost because the Russians wouldn't pay them.
Right.
And they became very good friends.
Stravinsky rewrote when the copyright laws changed. He went and he put new bar lines in all his music so he could recopyright it as new things.
We've done it far easier. Now we've changed the copyright law so we don't have to do that anymore. So now we've just extended it. Now it's about 75 years, but it was 25 years when he started. So what happened? That's true. He republished the pieces, making them slightly different.
When Peter Schickele.
I know him quite well.
And
he's from around here, by the way.
He's from Swarthmore.
Yeah.
And you went to school with him. You were at the Juilliard at the same time.
Yeah, we were.
And he wrote a concerto for horn and hardart. And I never knew this before. Maybe other people knew this. I mean, I knew that.
Do you know
that
what a hard? Do you know about horn and hardart?
And so tell him about the horn. Tell him about the hardart.
Well, the hardart. Well, he did a concert every year at the end of the year at Juilliard, and on the concert was a concert for horn and hardart. And his brother David and I built the hardart. We built the instrument.
He built the hardart.
Well, that didn't exist before until we
That's
built
right.
it.
That's right.
And he had collected a big bag of toys that made different sounds, different yeah. pitches. And David and I put together a big keyboard. But what we didn't tell him was that it was transposing instruments.
It was a transposing keyboard.
Well, we didn't tell him that. But so he came and looked at it and said, oh, this is that's the F and that's the C and this and that. And he was writing the piece for the hardart. And then when we were going to play it, it was in the wrong key. And he said, it sounds terrible. I said, but Peter, it's an F. He said, oh, my God. And so he found out. Of course, he didn't have any time to practice. He found out just before the concert.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had to transpose it. Inside.
Like it was a French horn player. It was an F.
I think, actually, we did it in A. So we didn't pick anything easy. But
So when what, then he wrote, but he got back at you because he wrote a piece after Einstein on the Beach came out.
Yes, he got his revenge. It took him a little few years. He asked me if I would. He was going to do a piece called Einstein on the Fritz. And he did a concert at Carnegie Hall every year for a long time.
Right.
And he was going to do it at Carnegie Hall, and he said, would I come? And I said, of course I'll come. But what I didn't know, he gave me my ticket. He put me right in the center of the orchestra, and he had a light on me.
For it's Einstein hard, on
hard,
the Fritz.
It's hard to be Peter when it comes to those kinds of things.
You can't, yeah, this is in a cage match, I suppose, with Peter Schickele. You actually have
notes?
I have too many notes.
I don't have any notes.
I have. No, you have this.
And oh, okay.
I don't have quite as much as you wrote. But a lot of people may not have known that you went to Juilliard and then you went and studied with Nadia Boulanger in France. And these are two institutions, both of them, of corners of American music, which... you went in completely different directions, and Nadia Boulanger, who taught Aaron Copland, who taught Virgil Thompson, and so many of the American composers, and you went in totally different directions. But her training was very rigid, and well, you went through that, and you came out as Philip Glass, though.
Well, when you say the training, it wasn't so much that it was rigid, but it was, she stayed very close to the fundamentals.
Yeah.
And basically, she found she had devised all kinds of ways of working so that what she was really teaching was, she was teaching you how to hear music, mm-hmm. to visualize, to be able to really hear music clearly. That was the first part of the training. And the second part of the training was, she, through very arcane maneuvers of hers, she taught you the difference between style and technique. Mm. That's a good one right there.
Mm-hmm.
The first one's good, too.
Yeah. Those two good things.
Which one do you want to hear about?
What's the difference between style and technique?
It was towards my end of my studies. Well, I'll tell you this. It may not be in the book. I don't know if I wrote this or not. And I thought, I just stopped at, it just seemed like big. There's a lot more I could have put in the
book.
Well,
see, this is the galley, so there's no index. I can't look it up. So there's no index.
But it is in the published
okay,
version.
All right.
Towards the end, I had been with her a number of years, and we had done all the counterpoint from starting with First Species. We had done all of that. I redone everything after I'd been at Juilliard. And the Bach chorales and the praise of Bach and all that business, did all that. And I came in one day with I usually had to bring in about 30 pages a week. She was, this was a serious business.
Right.
And I came in one afternoon and she looked at this piece of, this exercise I'd done, and she said, the resolution is incorrect. I said, no, Mademoiselle Boulanger, it's correct. She says, no, it's not correct. She said, and I had resolved the soprano in the root position on the root of the chord, and she said you have to resolve it on the third. Mm-hmm. And he said, it's not in the rules that we've been following. And then she did an amazing thing, and I don't know how she figured this out to do this. She reached behind the music rack of the piano. She pulled out a book, and it wasn't the Mozart piano sonatas. It was the Mozart piano violin sonatas.
Oh, okay.
So that you might not know. Mm-hmm. You were supposed to know the piano music, but this was a little different. And she picked it up, she opened it, and she pointed to a measure, and it was the same thing. And she said, look what Mozart did. And Mozart had resolved it on the third, not the root. And I was speechless. And I immediately understood that she had changed the rules. We were no longer talking about technique, we were talking about style. And I understood at that moment that what she was saying, and she never said it in words, but what she was saying basically that a personal style is a special case of technique. Mm-hmm. And then if you think about Brahms, or we talk about Rachmaninoff or Stravinsky, within a measure or two, you know who wrote what. Mm-hmm. And it's because they have selected from the whole category of let's say harmonic technique. They had developed a predilection for a particular way of resolving their voice leading. It's the way Rachmaninoff did it, it's the way Stravinsky did it. Whoever they did it, they had taken technique, the general class of technique, and by selecting their own inclinations, it became the special case of technique became their style.
But it's interesting that this came out, this revelation, when you pushed back. You pushed back a little bit, and then it came out. From her.
Yeah, I always push back. But what was interesting about it was that the third part of the thing that I understood right away was that the reason we were studying technique was so that it would be able to have the ability to create a style. In other words, without a solid technical basis, there won't be a style.
Right, you're just fishing.
So that's the relationship of style to technique, mm-hmm. And that is actually what she taught. She didn't teach composition, as far as I can. She didn't teach it with me. She may have done it with other people, but she never did it with me. That's what we did.
You said that you have a certain gene, the "I don't care what you think" gene.
Well, it didn't come when it came to Bourdieu. It was a little bit different.
Which may not relate to this as much, but how much has that carried you through your career?
Oh, it was invaluable. because when I was beginning, after my time with the Beckett plays and coming back to New York, and I was writing in a very reductive style, a very reductive way of working. I would do pieces that only had five notes in them, and they could go on for 20 minutes.
Okay, but not three notes, five notes.
Five notes. No, Tom Johnson did the one with three notes. I needed five. He was a real minimalist. I wasn't.
That's right. That's a proof right there. You heard it here.
But when I began performing these pieces, I'll give you a story that I think I did write about. I was in Europe. I began touring in Europe very shortly after I came back, and I was going back and playing in different places. And I was in Cologne, and I went to the radio station because it was famous for being a place for new music. Stockhausen used to run that place. Mm-hmm. But he had a young fellow about my age, I guess he was about 30 or so, and I who was looking at music, and I made an appointment. I wanted to show him what I was doing. I thought maybe they'd play it on the radio. So I probably brought in a piece, maybe it was Music and Fifths or some real hardcore, really minimalist.
Whatever you call it.
It was really hardcore. But we were playing it. It wasn't just iMusic. We performed this stuff.
Right.
And I was actually, I wasn't exactly making a living, but I was busily going around with an ensemble playing and paying the people that worked for it. So the music was taking its place, starting to take its place in the world. And I played that, and I showed this, and he looked at the music. And he looked at it for a while, and he finally said, very gently and very nicely, actually, he said, have you ever thought about going to music school? And I said, I'll give it some thought. Now, here's there's another part of the story. I came back about 3 years later. I was getting a little better known by then. And now I was playing, not on the radio, but I was in a big hall, and he came to the concert. But he forgot that we knew each other, and he liked the music a lot.
He liked it.
I never told him.
That's the best.
That he had met me before.
Keeping silent was the best revenge.
I've told you, though, and I've told you. If you ever run into him, you can tell him. But anyway, so the idea was that... The idea when I first came back to New York after my Boulanger years and my years with Ravi Shankar, for that matter, the same years.
Right.
And it was mostly considered that I was a musical idiot. And
you say
I didn't... What could I say?
But you didn't care.
Absolutely not.
Right. And when
I thought it was hilariously funny, actually.
Well, one event that wasn't funny at the time was this is a key to so much of your career is you're performing your music and you're performing your music, you're playing on the piano, and some fellow rushed the stage.
Well, this was in Europe,
and he was banging, as you said, Europe, they have these walls, and so he started banging on the piano, and what did you do?
Well, I knocked him off the stage, but it was not much bigger than here. And half the people cheered and half the people booed.
You know.
And I sat down and complained. And then afterwards he came on and he said, now we have the discussion. And I said, no, we had the discussion.
We had the discussion.
We're not going to discuss it with him. But then, that was a different matter. The idea that I was fooling around, I was there to make fun of him, that's a stupid idea.
Right.
I said, why would I go all the way to Amsterdam and arrange a concert just to make a fool of him?
Right.
I mean, what a self-important person that was, huh? So anyway, we had lots of wonderful bad reviews. I remember one in the Daily News, the title was Glass Invents New Sonic Torture. No, you can't make that stuff up.
Well, this is a substantial book, and of course a substantial life, and I have lots of notes, but I brought along about 200 or 300 of my closest friends to ask questions that I have not been able to. So we have, I think, Rachmaninoff and Stravinsky are manning the aisles, and they are holding microphones. So if you would like to ask a question of Philip Glass, you can raise your hand, and I will call on you and point to one of our assistants to bring you a microphone. And does anyone have a question? Right up here. Keep your hand up, please. There, that gentleman right there.
Good evening, Mr. Glass. I'm curious what you are most excited about in contemporary music right now.
What am I excited about in contemporary music? Well... there are two things that I'm very interested in. One is the encounters that I've personally made with indigenous composers from Mexico, Australia, Africa. You and I talked about this a little bit. Collaborations with other composers have been very interesting for me. But the other thing I began hearing very recently, there's a generation of composers getting close to 30 or maybe just over 30, I find the music very beautiful, and I have no idea what they're doing. It doesn't sound like me, thankfully. I'm not particularly attracted to minimalism. I've heard music by people. It sounds almost like music that you would hear in a dream. It's so... I can't make heads or tails of what the structure is or what it is, but it's just beautiful to listen to.
Is it electronic?
Some of it is. Uh-huh. there are people who are finding sounds from kind of cast-off parts of
right.
of what might have been an electronic studio, mm-hmm. and making sounds out of that. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly collage, though. Collage is in itself not particular. Collage is just putting things together. Mm-hmm. But I'm really hearing people writing pieces that are almost like dreams. Mm-hmm. It's very abstract. Mm-hmm. But what I like about it is I have no idea what it is.
That's a good place to start.
And I love to listen to it.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
But I would say also that at this point, we're talking about people that are 40 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. And I'm just happy that I'm living long enough to hear some of the new music that's being done. I'm doing what I do. I'm continuing in a path that I began. I have an agenda that I'm interested in. The language of my music evolves, but according to its own terms. But I don't feel a need to go... That has a development of its own. What I'm interested in is people who were not interested in that at all and just started someplace else. Mm-hmm.
And then you don't know what it is, but it's beautiful.
No.
That's good. Another question. Right up here on this side.
Mr. Bless, could you explain the difference between being reductive and being minimalist? And also, do you see any connection between minimalism in music and films and minimalism in our churches? Minimalism.
Do you understand?
Did you hear between minimalism and
minimalism
what?
In movie and performing arts, mm-hmm. And minimalism in our churches. I was reading a book about introducing music to our churches, and they said that once the music came and incorporated in the service and stuff like that, the content reduced and music started getting more and more and more. So in our churches, we have more music and we have less, we minimalized the...
Can you get this into
the one word I'm not picking up? It sounds like our churches.
Yeah.
Our churches.
Churches, religion in general. We have
okay.
We have more music, and we have less content. Yes. Content.
How much do you pay attention to the content in your music that's not the musical part of it?
A good question. Is that actually the question you asked? No, it isn't. But can I answer it anyway? Okay. One of the things that I've done quite a lot of, and it began when I first went to music school, and I asked myself who was wanted the music I was writing. I was about 20. Hmm. And I immediately found out that dancers wanted it, filmmakers wanted it, theater people wanted it, and I began writing for dance and for theater and for film almost immediately. I found that, and because of that, I got involved in interacting with, I talked a little bit before about text, movement, image, music, these four elements. To me, they were like the air, earth, fire, and water, the four elements of, let's say, theater. I became very interested in working in that way, and I ended up writing 10 symphonies, but that was because Dennis Russell Davies asked me to do it. I never thought I wanted to.
Right.
I wrote it for him. Left to myself, I almost always ended up in doing a theatrical work, mm-hmm. piece. And what I was interested in was that the encounters that I arranged in these theater works put me in touch with people whom I didn't know. In fact, I usually, when I did a succession of theater pieces, I almost never worked with the same people again. I would always get new people to work with. Mm-hmm. Because what I liked was having to solve a new problem. I liked being in the position where I didn't know how to do what I needed to do.
Well, your music has always changed over the years. I'm looking for other hands. Right up here, there you go, right on the aisle there.
Good evening, Mr. Glass. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about what inspired you to write two symphonies based on the music of David Bowie, Tony Visconti, and Brian Eno, and if their unique, certainly unique songwriting approach there influenced how you approach that task.
I was really thinking about it in a simpler way. Composers have traditionally, we've always done music based on other people, whether it was, it could be Bach or it could be anybody, Dvorak or Stravinsky. Most of those first three ballets of Stravinsky's, all that music is borrowed. It's borrowed from Russian folk music. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a book of Russian folk music that was edited by Rimsky-Korsakov that became the basis of all that music. So that it's very commonly we do that kind of thing. Now, I liked David's music and I liked Brian's. One of the things is that they did music together, but they never told me who did what, and I couldn't find out. If I asked them, they wouldn't tell me. But they would do. I later did discover that what they did is they would take a studio, and Brian would go in and work for 3 or 4 hours, and he would leave, and David would come back, and he would work on the same tracks. That's how they did it. They never worked actually in the same room at the same time. But I thought they were very, very gifted songwriters. And they were interested in making some kind of crossover into concert music. The music from Low was exactly like that. Lodger was another one that was like that. They did three records. Were in those days, we had an A side of a record and a B side. Do you remember that? The A side were the pop songs, and the B side was what they hoped would be their concert music. Mm-hmm. So yeah. They kind of started that already. So I decided to take the B side and to take it seriously. So I took the B side of the Low record, and I made a symphony out of it. And David didn't particularly like it, but he would play. I found out that I did another record, the Fourth Symphony. I did it again. He liked that one better, and he said, "In the reason he didn't like the Low one very much, he said it sounded too much like him. Whereas in the Fourth Symphony, he said it sounded more like me." But that's the kind of thing I would have said too.
You mentioned you have an agenda for your writing for the future. Would you like to share that with us?
What's that?
Your writing for the future.
Did I say that?
She looks trustworthy.
I do have things I want to do, but I didn't thought I hadn't revealed it to anybody yet.
But would you like to reveal it?
There's an opera that I have yet. I was working with Doris Lessing on operas. We did two. We did The Making of the Representative for Planet 8, and we did The Marriages Between Zones 3, 4, and 5, based on books of hers from the Canopus and Arcus series of books. Do you know her work, Doris Lessing? Some of you do. She wrote I wanted to do a trilogy, but for the third one, I picked up a book called Memoirs of a Survivor. Doris died before I got to that, but we had talked about it, and I told her I wanted to do the third book. I was going to do the third opera. I didn't know. She died not so much suddenly, but she was in her 90s, but she didn't look like she was going anywhere time too soon. And I was surprised when she passed away without very quickly. And I didn't get a chance to discuss it with her, except that we did talk about it. And she said she didn't want to do the adaptation, which she had done the first two stories. And I asked her whether Christopher Hampton could be the writer, who was a writer I've worked with. And she knew him. She said, yes, he would be fine. And I said, would you like to see the adaptation before we do the music? And she said, Lord, no. So that, I'm going to do it. I have a verbal permission from her. Now I have to get it from the estate, which, of course, is always. I think I'll probably get it because I've done the other two. I have a symphony number 11 that Dennis asked for. He's still asking for symphonies. So I've got to do that one.
He hasn't.
Brian Greene wrote a sequel to his Icarus at the Edge of Time story. Here's a string theory.
String, yeah.
And this is the sequel to that. And he's told me this finish, and I'm to write it this summer. And we're going to premiere it in November. That's what he told me.
So you got your summer, summer plan. You heard it here first.
Is there music always in your mind? Do you sing in the shower? Do you think about music as you drift off to sleep? I guess I'm interested in the creative process. Do you put music out of your mind when you're not really working on something that you're planning?
Well, why would I do that?
I wouldn't think that you do, but I'm just curious if you could talk about
other musicians about this, and what I find that many musicians are continually listening to music. Do you do that yourself? It's like I describe it sometimes as an underground river that's there. It's always there. It's always there. If you can tune into it anytime you want to. But that for people for whom that is a living, real part of the world, it's a very normal thing. It doesn't seem strange to us at all. And it's very common. It's quite common among musicians, among composers, and among players too.
Okay.
Hi. We had dinner like a couple years ago, and at Chez Panisse in Berkeley after Einstein on the beach. And you told me something that I thought was very uncommon, extraordinary, was that you, when you compose, just write the parts. And that organizes itself, it assembles in your mind. It's actually my question, which I didn't get to ask you then, which is, are you assembling these lines like a sculptor adding the clay? Well, or are you like the sculptor chipping away at the marble and it's already there as you compose?
I thought he was going to ask for another dinner.
It came about a
And that, also that.
This practice came about in a different way. I was an assistant for Ravi Shankar when he was working on a score. We sat in a room where there was a screen. He had the sitar. There were 10 or 12 musicians there. He looked at the movie, and he would say, okay, this is the oboe part, and he would play it. I would write the part down and give it to the oboe player. Then he said, here's the flute part, and I wrote the flute part. And we went through until we had done all of it. There was no score. And then I had to conduct it, and we recorded it. And now, that was very similar to exercises I had done with Boulanger, so it wasn't that. She had done something, made it even a very fiendish exercise. I'll tell you about it because it's so weird. But there was a Thursday class we called the Black Thursday class. She had six of her students, the six worst ones and the six best ones. But we never knew who was who. There was always something we had to solve when we got there, but on this particular day, I'll tell you about what happened. We walked in, and there was, on the piano was a, using in tenor clef, there was a line of music. And we looked at it. And she said, Danielle, would you sing the soprano part that goes with that? And he looked at it, and he sang a soprano part. And then no one wrote it down. Then she would say, Luis, would you do the tenor part? Now, of course, he had to remember the soprano part. He could see the part that was already written. So he added that one. And she said, we had done three of the four. Then she said, well, of course, the fourth one is easy now because you've done the first three. Of course, it's easy if you remember the first two, the other two. So basically, what you had to do was, and the way you learned to do this was by, there was only one way to do it, to learn it. You had to take the Bach chorales and you would learn one line and play the other three. Mm-hmm. And you had to do that. And I was given one chorale a week, which I had to learn. And when I came in, I had to do it. I had to perform
cold.
It.
Yeah.
If she asked me, and she often did not. But I dare not be unprepared. It thrown me out of the house, frankly. So by the time I was doing this exercise with Robbie, I said, oh, I know. That's what I used to do with her. So I did the whole score that way. And then I went back to New York. I was working with the guys I played with. And I had six players. And I decided, well, why should I write a score? First of all, no one wanted to see it. There was no one waiting to see my scores, nor did I send them out to anybody.
And you were performing.
I was performing it anyway. I had no reason to write the score, so I handed out all the parts. And all of Einstein on the Beach was composed that way. There was never a score to Einstein until some years later, some young fellow got some money from the New York State Council of the Arts to composite, to make a composite of the parts. And we finally had a score to Einstein, but it was maybe 7 or 8 years after I had composed it. But I didn't do scores until this character, Dennis Russell Davis, he wanted me to write symphonies. And then I was writing operas. Then I had to do it.
Because the guy asking you is the conductor. He wants to have a score in front of him. So
with Satyagraha, I had to write part. Yeah. I had to write a score.
I think we have time for one more question. Way in the back, in the middle.
Yes, great. Mr. Glass, I'm a scientist. I am devoid of any artistic capability or musical capability. I can't draw, paint, can't compose. However, I feel like the scientific process entails some creativity. And I have to say that some of the best ideas I've had for experiments have come when I've been listening to your music. And I guess I just wanted to ask you if you had any thoughts about the relationship between art or music, what have you.
Are you kidding? I think about it all the time. Especially when it comes to science. As a kid, my hobby was science. So I was studying astronomy, I built a telescope, I did all that kind of stuff. I wasn't that good at mathematics. I was good at arithmetic, but not that good at mathematics. And I understood at a certain point that I was much better at music than I would ever be at science. But I had gotten a taste for science. I've written an opera about Galileo. I have an opera about Einstein. I have an opera about Kepler. And someone asked me why I didn't do Newton. Well, the trouble with Newton was he never left his house, so nobody knows anything about Newton. And I couldn't figure out how to write an opera about someone that who wouldn't talk to anybody. He was a real... He was a... What do you call it? He was a...
Recluse?
More than that. He was a misanthrope. He didn't like people. Yeah. And there's a funny... There are so many funny stories about Newton that maybe I could just tell the funny stories. But... So I got in, and now I'm working with Brian Greene, who was a string theorist. I did the score for a film about Stephen Hawking called The Brief History of Time. So I got very interested in science. And one of the things, for example, I began to form the idea, now this, you might like this, I began to form the idea that scientists were actually poets. And I got that idea from something that Einstein said in in the 1940s, right after he became very famous because of the bomb, of course. He began writing books about relativity that anybody could understand, and more or less you could understand them. There were a lot of. I was born in 37, so I knew a lot about those books. That's what I grew up reading those books. But he describes one moment. He said that he was at that time working in Bern, Switzerland, at the patent office, you know, looking at inventions. Did you know that he did that? You did know that. So he would have to read these things and visualize how they worked and figure out whether they were real or not. Mm-hmm. So he must have been in the habit of thinking that. But in this book, he said that he imagined himself sitting on a beam of light, and the beam of light was traveling across the universe at the speed of light. And he looked around, and he saw that he was sitting still, and everything was rushing past him. And then he says this astonishing thing. He said, well, after that, all I had to do was figure out the mathematics to explain what I saw.
Philip Glass.
So by the idea, I got the idea that and then if I think about Darwin, if I think about Kepler, And you think, well, I know about scientists. I read about them and I study them. And I think of them as poets.
Thank you for the questions, and thank you. Thank you, Philip Glass.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.